Good evening. Governor orders the state to begin wearing face masks. Is the World Health Organization responsible for the coronavirus pandemic? Trump says yes, but many beg to differ. And why are people of color dying at a higher rate from the virus in New York City? Is it air pollution or budget cuts? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Wednesday, April 15th, 2020. Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the UK, and the US, all of which make up the group of the world's seven most industrialized countries, announced that they would support a temporary suspension of debt payments for the poorest countries if China also does. On Monday, the International Monetary Fund approved immediate debt relief for the world's 25 poorest countries, including Haiti, Afghanistan, Nepal, and Yemen. The rich debtor countries, known as the Paris Club, say for the moratorium to be effective, China, Russia, the Persian Gulf monarchies, and a multilateral financial institutions must accept the proposal. If this happens, 76 poor countries would not be obliged to pay about $20 billion for a year. The amount of African debt alone is about $365 billion. 40% of that debt is controlled by China. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund has denied an emergency loan to Iran, a nation under strict U.S. sanctions. Iran has asked the IMF for $5 billion to fight the coronavirus pandemic. Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, accused the fund of discrimination against his country. The virus has killed 4,000 people in Iran and infected 63,000. And President Trump's favorite drug for potentially treating COVID-19 disease failed a clinical study in Brazil. 11 people died in Manaus, the state of Amazonas, Brazil, during a study conducted with high doses of the drug chloroquine. After 3 days of treatment, those who received the highest doses of chloroquine began to have heart arrhythmias. On the sixth day of treatment, 11 died, leading the group of researchers to abandon the investigation. Meanwhile, as healthcare systems around the world are strained to the point of collapse, Cuban healthcare brigades have been invited to assist medical workers in Italy, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Suriname, Jamaica, and Grenada. 140 doctors from Cuba recently arrived in Jamaica, where they were welcomed at the airport in Kingston.
Needed to say a big thank you to the government and the people of Cuba for being here and for sending this 140 healthcare professionals, including doctors, nurses, therapists. I think this is great for the fight against corona here in Jamaica, and we really appreciate the support, as usual, of the Cuban government and the Cuban people. Thank you very much.
In stark contrast, U.S. officials are holding up aid to migrants on the Mexican side of the southern border. Red tape and rules on exporting medical gear have delayed work on a field hospital for migrants in an asylum camp near Brownsville, Texas. Mexican authorities approved construction of the 20-bed field hospital on April 2nd, but since then a trailer laden with supplies for the project has been parked less than a block from the U.S.-Mexico border. Global Response Management, the nonprofit spearheading the project, said the trailer contains an x-ray machine, cots, heart monitors, medical tents, generators, and other equipment. Due to a U.S. order banning the export of key protective medical gear, the nonprofit had to remove gloves, surgical masks, and N95 masks from the trailer in Brownsville. It's now trying to source what it can from Mexico. Health experts say the migrants are exceedingly vulnerable, their immune systems worn down after months living in closely packed tents. On Tuesday, President Trump pulled funding for the World Health Organization, the United Nations agency that coordinates the fight against coronavirus and other healthcare threats around the world.
Today, I'm instructing my administration to halt funding of the World Health Organization while a review is conducted to assess the World Health Organization's role in severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus. Everybody knows what's going on there. American taxpayers provide between $400 million and $500 million per year to the WHO. In contrast, China contributes roughly $40 million a year and even less. As the organization's leading sponsor, the United States has a duty to insist on full accountability. One of the most dangerous and costly decisions from the WHO was its disastrous decision to oppose travel restrictions from China and other nations. They were very much opposed to what we did. Fortunately, I was not convinced and suspended travel from China.
Trump's move prompted condemnation from world leaders as global coronavirus infections pass the 2 million mark. The president's allegations against the WHO contradict video of three January news conferences held by the organization warning of the virus. A news conference by the WHO on the coronavirus threat held on January 28th occurred hours after officials returned from China, where they met with health officials.
Ryan has just came back from his visit to China, where he accompanied Dr. Tedros and other WHO officials, where they met with health authorities and national authorities in China. You have received the press release on that last evening. So I'll give the floor to Dr. Ryan to tell us more about this visit.
Yes, we, Dr. Tedros and myself and the chef de cabinet, returned to Geneva today at 1:30 p.m. So this is our first opportunity to brief you on this. As you will have seen, the Director General, Dr. Tedros, has just announced that he will reconvene the International Health Regulations Emergency Committee on the new novel coronavirus 2019 nCoV tomorrow, to advise them on whether the current outbreak constitutes a public health emergency of international concern. His decision to reconvene the committee is based mainly on the evidence of increasing numbers of cases, on evidence for human-to-human transmission that has occurred outside of China.
That's a news conference held by the WHO on January 28, 2020. The United States is the world's worst affected country, and its coronavirus death toll topped 30,000 on Wednesday. More than 2,300 have died. After gradually becoming more hostile toward the Geneva-based WHO, Trump accused it on Tuesday of promoting Chinese disinformation about the virus, saying this had probably worsened the outbreak. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom spoke earlier today. He says he values the United States' friendship.
The United States of America has been a long-standing and generous friend to WHO, and we hope it will continue to be so. We regret the decision of the President of the United States to order a hold in funding to the World Health Organization. With support from the people and government of the United States, WHO works to improve the health of many of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people. WHO is not only fighting COVID-19, we're also working to address polio, measles, malaria, Ebola, HIV, tuberculosis, malnutrition, cancer, diabetes, mental health, and many other diseases and conditions. We also work with countries to strengthen health systems and improve access to life-saving health services. WHO is reviewing the impact of our work of any withdrawal of U.S. funding, and we'll work with our partners to fill any financial gaps we face and to ensure our work continues uninterrupted. Our commitment to public health, science, and to serving all the people of the world without fear or favor remains absolute. Our mission and mandate are to work with all nations equally, without regard to size of their populations or economies. COVID-19 does not discriminate between rich nations and poor, large nations and small. It does not discriminate between nationalities, ethnicities, or ideologies. Neither do we. This is a time for all of us to be united in our common struggle against a common threat, a dangerous enemy. When we're divided, the virus exploits the cracks between us.
Tedros Adhanom is the Director General of the World Health Organization. The United States contributed more than $400 million to the WHO in 2019, roughly 15% of its budget. A senior administration official said Washington would stop a $58 million assessed contribution that was due to be paid for 2020. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Democrats will swiftly challenge what she called President Trump's senseless and illegal suspension of U.S. funding to the World Health Organization. In related news, China has imposed new rules restricting the publication of academic research on the origins of the novel coronavirus. Under the new policy, all academic papers on COVID-19 will be subject to extra vetting before being submitted for publication. The outbreak is generally believed to have first appeared in the city of Wuhan last December. Trump's repeated claims that the virus is from China has resulted in numerous physical attacks against Asian people in the United States. In national news, New York City remains at the center of the United States COVID-19 epidemic. Governor Andrew Cuomo on Wednesday mandated that New Yorkers wear masks or other face coverings in people-packed public areas. He said the order would go into effect in 3 days, adding that no one has the right to infect another person.
Issue an executive order that says all people in public must have a mask or nose covering, mouth and nose covering, and they must wear it in a situation where you cannot or are not maintaining social distancing. Meaning what? Meaning the same thing we've been saying from day one. If you're going to be in public and you cannot maintain social distancing, then have a mask and put the mask on when you are not in socially distanced places. You're walking down the street, you're walking down the street alone, great. You're now at an intersection and there are people in the intersection and you're going to be in proximity to other people, put the mask on. Your right to go out for a walk in the park, go out for a walk because you need to get out of the house, the dog is getting on your nerves, fine. Don't infect me. You don't have a right to infect me. If you are going to be in a situation in public where you may come into contact with other people in a situation that is not socially distanced, you must have a mask or a cloth covering nose and mouth. That is by executive order. So if you're going to get on public transit, you're going to get on a bus, you're going to get on a subway, you're going to stand on a subway platform, you're going to walk in a neighborhood that is busy, you're going to be on a sidewalk, you're going to pass other people on a sidewalk, you're not going to be able to maintain social distancing, you must wear a mask. Or cloth, or an attractive bandana, or a color-coordinated bandana, cloth, but you have to wear it in those situations. We'll give people 3-day notice to allow compliance, just on the off chance that somebody doesn't have a cloth covering or a mask, and we'll go from there. On the ventilators,
after Mayor Bill de Blasio called on grocery stores in the five boroughs to require that shoppers cover their mouths and noses, and nearly 2 weeks after the mayor's April 2nd advice to all city residents to cover up outside. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Last night, President Trump announced the membership of a task force he's been extolling as part of his plan to reopen the economy next month. He calls the task force the Great American Economic Revival Industry Groups. But according to a review of the 202 names of task force members released by the White House, just 20 were women and 7 African Americans. 27 members are donors to Trump's campaigns, giving a combined $41.2 million since 2015. Members include professional wrestling magnate Vince McMahon, Oracle CEO Larry Ellison, equity giant Blackstone CEO Steven Schwarzman, and Home Depot co-founders Ken Langone and Bernie Marcus, who've given $1.5 million to Trump's campaign. And a new report from Harvard researchers says coronavirus patients exposed to increased air pollution before the pandemic are more likely to die from COVID-19 than those unexposed to the pollutants. An analysis of more than 3,000 U.S. counties by researchers at the Harvard University T.H. Chan School of Public Health found that higher levels of the particles known as PM2.5 were associated with higher death rates from the disease. The Harvard analysis is the first nationwide study to show a statistical link between dirty air and deaths from COVID-19. A professor of biostatistics at Harvard is Francesca Domenici. She says the study was limited by a shortage of demographic data, but the conclusions are clear. Poor people and people of color are among the first to die.
The data that are available to us are suggesting is that fine particulate matter could definitely make the symptoms and the clinical consequences of COVID worse.
What are fine particulate matter? Where does it come from?
Fine particulate matter is a type of air pollution. The main sources of fine particulate matter are fossil fuel combustions, so what comes from the smokestack of power plants, and also comes from traffic emissions. Traffic and power plants, these are the two major sources of fine particulate matter. They are regulated by Environmental Protection Agency because there's been a tremendous amount of evidence about their harmful effect. And the reason why they are so harmful, sometimes when you're walking in New York and there is a construction site, you tend to breathe some of that dust. But these are larger particles, and so you have the ability to cough them out. The very fine particulate matter, the one that comes from traffic and power plants, you don't see them, you don't feel them, and they just, therefore, they can really get very, very deep into your lungs.
And does this relate to what we've been seeing is the tremendous disparity in COVID cases?
Yes. We haven't done the rigorous science to say that with higher level of confidence, but clearly we believe that that could be also a factor. We know, again, from the previous studies, not only by my own team, but by many of my colleagues, we have well documented that racial minority, and in particular Afro-American, tends to get a worse health outcome, higher mortality risk from exposure to fine particulate matter. For all types of reason, because of the higher level of comorbidity, because of issues with environmental justice in terms of that people that are in the most vulnerable population tends also to breathe higher pollution level. So I think that there is, all of the different pieces of evidence as they are accumulating, they can definitely point toward the fact that exposure to fine particulate matter could be, once again, a really important factors into driving the mortality rate for Afro-Americans for COVID much higher than the rest of the population.
I was a teacher in the Bronx, and that we had a lot of big problem with asthma. Is this part of that same problem that contributes to asthma we see?
Yes. All of these sources of pollution, whether is asthma in kids or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in elderly, I think it's something that we always have to take a lot of attention. But I do think that right now, in the middle of a pandemic, and I think in a world right now where we will need to live with these viruses, I think we should even pay extra attention because we want to make sure that both kids clearly and adults and elderly don't have lungs already compromised because of air pollution in presence of a virus that itself also cause inflammatory responses and problems with your respiratory system.
Anything you'd like to add?
It's unfortunate that data on COVID deaths and hospitalization tends to be, for the most part, only available at the aggregated level. And I think that making data available, more information about racial minority and on a smaller racial scale, at smaller spatial resolution, can really help us to address many of the questions that you've been asking me.
There was such a paucity of that kind of data that, in fact, up until the there was almost an outcry for it. The different urban areas were not providing that kind of data.
Right. Without data, it's very hard for our scientists to be able to inform the public and make the most wise policy recommendation. To the degree that something can be done to release the data and, for example, give us the number of deaths for COVID by racial minority or by age or by census tract, that will really allow us to really address some of the most important pressing questions that everyone is asking.
Are they doing this on purpose, suppressing this data on purpose?
I really don't know. There are some of the public health departments that are overwhelmed and they might not have the support that is needed to release the data at the smaller scale that we need in a timely fashion. And I don't want to speculate on that, but it's enormously important this time of crisis as we're trying to really help the population to make this data available so then scientists can make the proper recommendations.
Francesca Dominici is a professor of biostatistics at Harvard University T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The Trump administration opted Tuesday not to set stricter national air quality standards for fine particulate matter, the country's most widespread deadly pollutant, subject of the last story. Several big business groups in Washington, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and American Petroleum Institute, cheered the administration for retaining the existing standards. And as New York City remains the epicenter of the global COVID-19 pandemic, its effects are being felt differently across neighborhoods, says a report from the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. The organization says the virus is hitting low-income communities of color the hardest, and that residents of those communities are disproportionately employed in frontline occupations while facing some of the highest rates of rent and overcrowding. Recent data released by the city's Department of Health shows that Black and Latinx New Yorkers are dying at twice the rate of whites, and at the heart of the problem is the closure of 18 hospitals in the last two decades that serve these communities. Chris Walters is one of the authors of the report.
It's really proving in New York and in the country to be not just a public health crisis, but really an economic and racial justice crisis as well. And that it is really hitting communities in very disparate ways. So New York is the epicenter of the epidemic at the moment, but there are really epicenters within New York, and those are all lower income communities of color, where a disproportionate number of residents are frontline service workers. So the folks who really are keeping New York City running. And they're the folks who are getting hit hardest by COVID. There's sort of a host of historic inequities behind this, but one that really stood out in a striking fashion was the location of hospital closures over the past two decades. At least 18 hospitals have been closed in New York in the past two decades. Two-thirds of those were in the outer boroughs, and the majority of those fell in these very same low-income communities of color that are bearing the brunt of the coronavirus crisis today.
There were some specific cases you mentioned in your report of hospitals were closed and replaced with multi-million dollar luxury developments.
The most high profile one was St. Vincent's Hospital that was really at the forefront of fighting the AIDS epidemic and treating poor New Yorkers there. Just a long history in the West Village that was closed for luxury condos that, again, are wildly expensive in their price. More recently, Long Island College Hospital, which was considered the first teaching hospital in the United States, was demolished and is being replaced by residential, one of these developments, you know, a studio just went for over $1.15 million. And then you're seeing it in the outer boroughs as well. St. John's Hospital in Elmhurst, which again is really one of the big epicenters of the pandemic in New York, was replaced by market rate housing not too long ago. Similar story in a lot of different neighborhoods.
How do we get here? Did this start with the Bloomberg administration, as you write, or did it go before that?
This is a host of things, but it is, I think, a mentality that the Bloomberg administration brought, and that sort of our entrenched, I think, approach to planning still brings, in that we don't look at planning for our city in a comprehensive fashion, and we don't look at it in a fashion that really sort of centers equity. These hospitals in general were ones that served lower income residents, either of the neighborhood or of New York City. They did not take folks who didn't have private insurance. Hospitals that weren't going to make as much of a profit as those that are able to cater to a wealthier clientele. You see closures based on that, but it's also part of this larger emphasis on housing development and luxury housing development being central and being addressed in sort of a piecemeal fashion, neighborhood by neighborhood. What ends up happening is that lower income communities of color are disinvested in, while luxury housing is built piecemeal throughout the city, not in a fashion that is aimed at really serving folks who are in need, housing for folks who are most in need.
And there were zoning changes that were part of this too.
There were, and it varies again by neighborhood. But again, this is sort of part and parcel of an approach to planning that is very zoning based, built around increasing density for more housing, but not with a commensurate amount of public value as part of that. So when you demolish St. Vincent's and then allow the developer additional ability, an ability to build a much larger building, you've created massive profits for those folks without a commensurate amount of public benefit and gain being achieved as part of that rezoning.
Does this relate to the cutbacks that were attributed to the administration of Governor Andrew Cuomo in the state as well?
Yes, it is. So that this is a lot of these hospitals, and some of this predates Cuomo, but a lot of these hospitals were identified by a state commission as one that should close. When Medicaid funding is cut, that is largely money that is going to help maintain these hospitals. That's money that's going directly to these public hospitals and these hospitals that serve a lower income population. So that is why we and others have called right for Medicaid should not be cut as part of the state budget. And obviously, especially in this moment of crisis.
What answer do you have to this? What can we do to change things given what we're in right now?
First and foremost, there is some immediate, you know, relief that is needed for workers and households who are suffering the most. So that's things like rent relief. That's things like hazard pay. That's making sure that unemployment insurance goes to everybody, that it goes to immigrants as well and folks that have been cut out of that by the federal government. And then I think it also means as we sort of move forward in this new reality that we really need a new approach to planning that is equity focused and that is comprehensive, that uses zoning, that uses policy, that uses capital investments to really try to change this segregated and unequal landscape that is unfortunately playing out in these life and death terms right now.
Chris Walters of the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. Governor Cuomo is proposing to cut Medicaid by $400 million, part of a $2.5 billion in cuts he's seeking over several years. New York State has lost more than 20,000 hospital beds over the last 20 years. That's some of the news for Wednesday, April 15th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.